I'm Neely Powell, the founder and CEO of Charleston Shoe Company, and this is my startup story.
Every wildfire began with a spark. Every superhero has an origin story, and every single startup has a moment that they point to as their beginning, and every founder has a purpose that drove them in the midst of all obstacles. That is the startup story. The startup story would not be possible if it wasn't for the support of our sponsor, MoboCash. Move money like a miracle with MoboCash, the free money app that kicks cash. Download MoboCash app on iTunes or Google Play today, and you'll get your slick new Mobo card in the mail. You are no longer dependent upon digital currency alone, but you'll have a card that allows you to purchase at POS stations, restaurants, buy online, anywhere that you want to use your money. No credit check, no credit impact, quick direct deposit, FDIC insured, and free to register and activate. Support our sponsor, MoboCash. Visit movo.cash or thestartupstory.co/movocash. Before we jump into our episode this week, I want to share a review that was written on iTunes by Hurdles1, who gave the startup story a 5-star rating and wrote, but let me just warn you, this is a great write-up, and it's a little lengthy, but it's so good. Hurdles1 wrote, "We have all read or seen or heard of the startup that came from nowhere and had immediate success. However, if you dig a little deeper, you'll find that the entrepreneur driving the successful startup often did not have overnight success. Instead, their journey was one of obstacles and challenges, doubts, false starts, restarts, transformation, and unrelenting drive toward their vision. The path to success is far too often a solo journey, but it doesn't have to be. The shared knowledge of founders, entrepreneurs, and changemakers can now be accessed through this great podcast. James McKinney has a natural conversational style that allows his guests to clearly and concisely share their journey, their insights, and their best practices, allowing you to tap into the collective knowledge of other great entrepreneurs. I have enjoyed each episode and look forward to each future episode. You should definitely check out this podcast if you have a curious mind and a desire to understand the road to success." Wow, I'm speechless, Hurdles1. I can tell you've been listening to these episodes because you're using some of the same language that we use in the podcast. Such powerful stuff. This was an unbelievable review, and I'm incredibly grateful for the time you put into it. I hope you will copy and paste this review and share it along with a link to the podcast in your LinkedIn profile. This was meant for entrepreneurs, and our LinkedIn networks are just flooded with entrepreneurs and aspiring entrepreneurs. So let's get this out there on LinkedIn. We are a startup ourselves, and getting the word out about the podcast is a top priority. These founder stories are for the masses. So if you found value in any of the Startup Story episodes, please leave a review. I'll continue to read one each week, so plug your brand in the review as well. Giving your business a plug is the least I can do if you take the time out of your day to write a review. Now let's jump into this week's episode. Our guest today is an absolute fireball of a human being. Her story runs at 100 miles per hour from the minute her journey gets rolling. Our featured founder today is Neely Powell, the founder of the Charleston Shoe Company. Neely's name was given to me by a male listener who simply reached out to me via email and let me know that, to use his words, "You will be floored by Neely's story." Well, he was not lying. The growth that the Charleston Shoe Company is experiencing is remarkable. At the time of this recording, Neely had 20 stores open and was in the midst of opening another 6 stores nationwide within the next 6 weeks. Like I said, Neely is growing the Charleston Shoe Company at an unbelievable rate. In this episode, you will hear exactly how powerful a belief in your own ability can be, even in the most challenging environment. You will learn how shifting your perspective of an obstacle to look at it as an opportunity can change your business dramatically. And you will discover how important it is to stay focused on the issue and not to allow the turbulence of the problem itself to distract you. Neely started the Charleston Shoe Company in 2011. Well, technically she started it during her time in college, but at the time she only saw it as a side hustle. But those were her college years. Like all great stories, we need to start at the very beginning. And Neely's story, much like the growth of the Charleston Shoe Company, starts off very, very different than most others.
My father he developed a lot of real estate and conceptualized about 30 restaurants and bars in Memphis, Tennessee.
Oh, wow.
In the 70s, he was straight out of college, and him and 3 friends opened all these restaurants and bars in Memphis, Tennessee. And ran them, came up with concepts. The main restaurant there was TGI Fridays, which was the first Fridays outside of New York.
Okay.
So this was a big deal for Memphis. The day that he opened all of those restaurants and bars, he had liquor by the drink passed in the state of Tennessee. And so prior to that, no one could go into a bar and order a drink. So this was a huge thing for Memphis and a huge thing for the Mid-South in general. So there was a lot of excitement all through the 70s and early 80s. By 1985, he got pretty burned out, and he moved myself, my six-month-old sister, and my mother to Costa Rica, where he started a fishing rod company while he was looking for a place to build a resort on an island. Wow. And this was going to be his retirement, right? So he gets a call in 85 that there's an island for sale in the Florida Keys, and we moved there. You would have thought from my grandparents that we had moved to Africa, but we moved to the Florida Keys. And while we were living there, my mother, she had a bunch of retail stores in Memphis, ladies' clothing stores. And she also started importing furniture from a small colonial town in central Mexico. And so we spent our summers there going, and she'd bring back suitcases full of product and have trunk shows every week selling clothing, furniture, accessories, all of this. And of course, I was raised in those stores, in those restaurants, in the hotels, and in, you know, all these trunk shows that she was doing, and in the manufacturing side of things as well. So yes, I was definitely raised by two very ambitious people, but I just thought that's the way everyone was. So it wasn't like I really just wanted to be an artist or an architect in the early days. So
if you think to your high school years, what were you thinking your trajectory was? Was it to start your own enterprise or something else?
No, I really did want to be an artist or an architect. So I actually, out of college, I was accepted into the architecture program at the University of Miami. And I was supposed to attend, and I ended up taking a few month sabbatical before I went in San Miguel, Mexico, which is where my shoes are made. And I was working in the factories there, and that's when everything changed.
Let's talk about, before we jump to San Miguel, because that is where things changed for you.
Right.
Being raised by entrepreneurs or not being raised by entrepreneurs, it has a way of shaping our mindset and how we, what we think of our future. You know, I was raised by an entrepreneur, and for me, you know, I fought it. I was like, I do not want this life. I do not want this grind and not want the heartache and the challenges that come with it. And so I did not want that for the longest time, but inevitably it's who I was. So I couldn't avoid it. What was your thought process having been raised by entrepreneurs? Was it something you fought and you had wanted nothing to do with it? Or was it something you embraced and saw some opportunities in architecture and art, which is what you were passionate about?
I think I pretty much embraced it, but I'm kind of that way with everything. I mean, I don't really say no to anything, and I don't really think about being from something as an obstacle. I only think of it as being an opportunity. And so that's probably the mindset that they taught me. So I was constantly coming up with every project I could come up with. And there was always this sense of urgency and this sense of, I just need to go and do this. And I'm not really going to think about how I'm going to do it. I'm just going to go have fun and do it. It's summers. I was running children's camps that I started. You know, there was always a business going on in my head, but it was all for fun. It was never really about money as much as it was just these creative projects that I did for the fun of it.
So that's interesting. You know, you mentioned these children camps, right? So I assume that was before you went off to college. So what were some of these other, I mean, I'm assuming that's probably not the only hustle you had early on. You know, what were some of the other ventures you started as a kid?
Yeah, so my sister was young and I was taking care of her anyway. So every summer I'd have these summer camps and have all of her friends, and we'd do all kinds of arts and craft projects, and then I'd serve them lunch. And this was before I even knew how to drive. I was probably 10, 11, 12, taking care of these 3, 4, 5-year-olds. And then
awesome.
I kept doing it until I went to college. It was the Creative Kitty Camp was the name of it. But instead of your typical lemonade stand, I'd be painting rocks and shells and selling them on the side of the street or in my mother's stores or in my dad's restaurants or in the hotel. I played piano a lot, and so my dad would pay me to come and play at the resort at dinner at night. I'd meet all of these characters. The resort was very eclectic. It's a small 5-acre resort, only accessible by boat. He built 30 thatched bungalows, and it was one of the first relais and chateaus in the country. So it was very upscale and way, way before its time. He had no TVs or telephones in any of the rooms. The phone number was 1-800-3-GET-LOST because he wanted people to come and decompress. This was before we even had cell phones. No one was walking around with a cell phone anyway or a laptop, but his vision was, you're going to come here. So we had a lot of the Bushes, Rod Stewart, all kinds of characters that would come there for a week or what have you. And I'd be in there meeting all of them, entertaining these people and playing the piano for them at night. And then the next day I'd get in a boat and go to school in a trailer in the Keys.
Oh my goodness.
Half of my class was, a lot of them were from Cuba. They had come over here with their grandparents and parents. And it was such a difference for me, the juxtaposition to go to Little Palm at night or during the day and then go to my normal childhood life in the Keys, barefoot, running around, taking a boat to school was so different. And it taught me how to be able to interact and talk to any walk of life, if that makes sense.
Oh, that's incredible. What a great childhood. So now let's jump to your time in San Miguel.
We started visiting there in the mid 80s. And my mom, like I said, would import all of this furniture and accessories. And one day, my mother and I are walking through the streets and we stumble into this little maybe 50 square foot store with a dirt floor. And Santiago, my current cobbler, was in there with his wife, Martha. He was making shoes and I bought a pair and my mom bought a pair. And every time we'd go back, I was 16 at the time, the first pair that I bought, I was 16. And every time we'd go back, friends would say, oh, bring me a pair. I want a pair. And I would just start bringing back shoes and shoes and my mom would too. And when I got to college, I started going to wholesale furniture markets with my mother on the weekends and helping her sell furniture. I'd noticed at all the shows that there are all these women wearing uncomfortable shoes. And my mom and I are wearing the shoes we bought in San Miguel because they're so comfortable and you can stand in them all day. It dawned on me, why don't I start bringing these shoes to these markets and sell them to these women wearing stilettos on their feet, walking 30,000 steps a day. And so my mom would have these beautiful booths. She's selling the Neiman Marcus, Target, everything. They're beautiful booths. And here I am. I become this like shoe lady, like all these women and decorators are flocking to these booths going, I heard you have these really incredible, comfortable shoes. And I'm making a total mess on the floor in her showroom while she's trying to write hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of orders to these big buyers. And I'm just creating havoc with all these women and these shoes. And so by the time I got out of college, these women that would purchase them would then get home and they'd have such a reaction from their customers and their friends and their clients that I kind of started a wholesale business on the side. So they'd call and they'd say, can I order 4 dozen pairs and sell them to people? So by the time I got out of college, we probably had about 200 wholesale accounts.
Wow.
And I was going to these markets, selling the shoes, and really, I mean, not making a dime doing it because there were no margins and everything I received was incorrect. But that's the beginning of that story.
So while you're doing this, though, I mean, this is something that you're doing during college, correct?
Right.
What was your mindset in this? Was this just, I'm making money to pay for college? Was this something that you thought had long-term play in it? What was your thought process in this?
There was no thought process. Like, I was literally just selling shoes. I knew that I needed to go to the furniture markets with my mother. I had fun doing it. I had fun with her and her partner, Bob. And this was just a side gig that the customers kept me doing it, because every time I go, they'd come up and say, "Where are the shoes?" So there was really no not doing it, if you will. There were so many points where it was just a nuisance. It was a plain nuisance and a headache. And I didn't think of it as a sustainable business at the time. I was just really working for my mother's furniture business.
Got it.
And this was a total side gig that I never thought had any teeth to it until probably my late 20s.
Late 20s, that's post-college, right? So you finish college, you have 200 wholesale accounts. You know, you said there's no margin in wholesale because obviously they have to get their margin on their side too. What was that next step for you as you finished college and have these wholesale accounts?
I just continued to, for the next 10 years, work in my mother's furniture business. Like I said, I was doing this to cater to these customers that wanted the shoes, but it was so difficult. I would call the factory. Now, granted, this was way before any kind of this technology. Yeah. And I was literally calling Mexico, speaking my broken Spanish. There's no FaceTime. There's no like real email per se of trying to see samples and get samples.
Yeah.
I'm calling and I'm saying, okay, well, I just went to market and I sold 200 pairs of black, you know, Monterey's. And I'd placed an order over the phone with them. A week later, I'd get 200 pairs of yellow Lafayette's. And I go, well, none of my customers want these. And I certainly can't sell a yellow shoe. So what am I going to do? And this continued. And these customers that I was getting, I could sell to them individually a shoe. But if they're placing an order for their stores, they don't want the yellow shoe. They want what they ordered.
Yeah.
So it was just a lot of, it was a very much a side gig and a headache.
Yeah.
And I think when I turned 29, I was pregnant with my daughter at the time, and I just kind of quit. I just said, I'm not making any money here. I'm not doing this. And I quit. Once I had her, I was home for a few months, and I said, you know what? I'm going to start my own shoe business. I went back to school. I went to SCAD, Savannah College of Art and Design, and took shoe design. I registered for just the classes I needed to take. I moved 10 hours away from my home with a one-year-old.
Oh, man.
And went to school and learned. I knew how to sew a button, maybe, but I literally physically had to make shoes. And so I'm in these classes with these 17, 18 year olds, and I'm 30 with a 1 year old, and I'm taking all these design classes. And it dawned on me that the person to my left is making a blue suede studded 7-inch heel. Who are you going to sell that to? I mean, there are very few people you're going to sell that to. I just kind of thought back to the practicality of the shoes that I'd been selling all those years.
Yeah.
And took what I was learning from there and realized, too, I'm in this town, Savannah, Georgia. Paula Deen's really big then. There are tons of people just being bussed into Savannah. And these tourists are just, I mean, they're 12 million tourists at the time a year. Wow. If you come to Savannah, instead of buying a coffee mug with Savannah on it, what if you bought a pair of shoes that was comfortable, functional, great for travel, great for walking, and it was named the Savannah Shoe Company? Then it's a tourist item, and at the same time, it's a souvenir, but it's something you actually want, especially women. I found a store downtown Broughton Street in Savannah before I'd finished my program. I called Santiago, my original cobbler, and I said,
"The one you had problems with, right?"
Yes, exactly. And I said, "Listen, I want to do this." My thought was, if I opened a retail store and he sent me those 200 pairs of yellow shoes, I can sell that to women that are walking in off the street. You know, I designed these styles with him. We started with like 5 styles and 5 colors each. And I opened my door in April of 2010 and started selling these shoes.
Oh my goodness. So you covered a lot of ground there.
Sorry.
No, that's great. This is great. But now I want to go back and I want to piece and poke at a few things real quick. So you were 30 with a 1-year-old and you make the decision to leave the comfort and support of family to go yes. to SCADS. Again, that takes a lot of courage and gumption. And I'm sure there's probably listeners out there right now that find themselves with a young child and a book full of dreams and they're not sure how to pursue it. What was going on with you mentally that you said, this is a decision I'm making because it's bold?
I'm sure that 90% of my friends thought I was completely crazy. And to this day, they will say that we came to visit you in Savannah and we all thought that you had just flown off your rocker. But there really was no, again, it's kind of the way that I was raised. I really, other than flying, I really don't have a fear in trying something and realizing that life is short and realizing a sense of urgency and realizing that if I come up with something in my head, I just want to go do it. Mm. And that's just the way I've always been. My dad died when I was 21. And I think that there has always been that sense of life is short. Yeah. Let's go make the most of it and have fun while we're doing it and just, you know, not procrastinate on things. So I don't know. There was really never any fear. There was just kind of like, I have this idea, so let me go try it. And I did. And I didn't have any money to go try it either. Keep in mind, I put college on my credit card. Mm. I rented a house in Savannah with my 1-year-old at the time. And I had her in this daycare downtown that I don't know how I did it. I definitely maxed myself financially to be able to do it. And then my mom and her partner, Bob, loaned me $5,000 to pay first and last month's rent on my store. That was the last dime I borrowed.
I do believe that there are listeners right now that find themselves in a spot that most people would say there's just no way out other than get a steady job and provide. And there's obviously nothing wrong with getting a steady job and providing. But you saw something more for yourself and for your child and your future. One of the things that those people listening where they're kind of stuck, you know, they don't know what to do because they want to pursue more, but they have these responsibilities. And again, it doesn't even have to be the single parent. It could be the person that has responsibilities of a mortgage and kids, and maybe they're 60 and they think they're too old to pursue their dreams. If you were to think back to that time, what was the worst case scenario for you to make that move and that jump and be that bold?
Probably that I just failed and then I'd come home and continue doing what I was doing. But I didn't really think about the failure aspect of it. I just thought about the opportunity. I just, again, it was just one of those things that this is a fun idea and a creative idea, and I'm going to try it. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And then I'll come home and I'll get another job and I'll pay off all this credit card debt and I'll figure it out. But it was probably a few years ago that I even had the thought process of thinking about failure and thinking about actively making a profit.
Yeah.
I mean, everything was just part of the adventure. It really had nothing to do with money, even though I needed money at the time. It really had nothing to do with that. It just had to do with, this is something I want to do in my life and I'm going to go do it.
I think that's one of the things that in our short time before before we did this recording, that impressed me most is just how bold you are and how right your perspective is, right? You know, you didn't think about failure. It's just, this is what you wanted to do and you went for it. And I think that a lot of the reason that people stop and have paralysis by analysis is that they amplify what the worst case scenario is. And that's not even the real worst case scenario, right? I mean, it's just not, to you, the worst case scenario was that you don't succeed and you have a lot of credit card debt and you come home. And it could have gotten a whole lot worse than that. But to you, that was like, okay, that's the worst case scenario. I come home. Like, no big deal. You weren't paralyzed by that. And I think so many people do. And that's why I love about your story is that you just didn't let those things stop you. And so now you know, here you are in the midst of your program, not even finished yet. You're adding to your debt with your mom helping you with that first and last for a storefront. You're talking with your cobbler in San Miguel. Retail's a tough business, and now you're jumping into the retail space. You know, how old is your daughter at this time?
She's, you know, 2.5 maybe.
So she's 2.5 now. Let's walk through those early days of now a retail storefront. You've got staffing you've got to worry about. You got your program you still got to get through. What was the early days of the Savannah Shoe Company like for you?
I opened on this store. It was the busiest store, the kind of main street of Savannah called Broughton Street. And there's not a lot of retail in Savannah at the time. I had my daughter and I would go to the store every day and no one was on the street, period. And I just went, what have I done? And so I'd stand outside of the store every day with two different shoes on. Every time someone walked by, I'd say hello to them. And they either would say hello back and think I was completely crazy and feel sorry for me and come in the store, or, you know, they completely ignore me because they were scared of me. I think that there was this sense then, and it's really never died, of the atmosphere that I was trying to create in this shop, which was having fun and coming into your best friend's closet and talking to these people and interacting with them. The sideline was that I'm selling this product that is absolutely magical. If you could talk those people into coming in the store and actually putting the shoe on their foot, they just were mesmerized and they go, this is the most comfortable thing I've ever put on my foot and I need three pairs. And I remember when I sold our first few pairs of shoes, I went, well, today I can pay for my electricity bill and tomorrow I can pay for my water. The next day I can pay for my child's daycare. There was this constant sense of referral too, which was awesome. I mean, I didn't have any money to advertise, so I was literally selling the best I knew how, trying my hardest to get people in the door, and then creating this impression on these people that made them tell other people. And so everyone, it just really got into the water and people just started coming in and saying, I was at this restaurant last night and this woman had on these shoes and she literally was a stranger and she let me try them on and I love them and that's why I'm here. And that story was every day.
Wow.
There was a great story about my mother-in-law at the time. She was in another shoe store and this woman looked down at her foot and said, I love those shoes. I need those. And she goes, well, you know, my daughter-in-law sells them. Here's her website. You can go get them there. And she goes, no, I want them for a wedding tonight. She literally bought the shoes off her feet.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness.
But these stories are everywhere, you know? I mean, it was these women getting on an elevator and multiple people would be in the shoes and, you know, they go, aren't they the best? And they are. They're magically comfortable. They fit so many feet. And, you know, I was just lucky that on top of the hustle and the entrepreneurship that I had, I was also selling just this very well-made, awesome product.
Yeah.
It started to take off. And so then I hired my first employee and I went
that's great. But how long? So all of this buzz is building up on the Savannah, it's still Savannah Shoe Company at the time. All this buzz is building up on Savannah Shoe Company. You're making an incredible product. People are referring like crazy. People are reselling them off of their feet for weddings. And you still don't have a first employee. What is that time span from opening to first employee?
So let's see. I opened the store in April. I think I hired my first employee in July.
So you took off like a rocket then from the buzz and word of mouth. That is amazing.
I really actually hired that employee so I could go back to Memphis, back to my family. Mm. Every time I'd go back to Memphis, the employee that I had in place, you know, our sales would go from $500 a day to like $10 a day.
Oh, wow.
The difference was completely drastic. Mm. So I remember it was like, maybe August or something of that year. And my mom goes, we are getting in the car. I don't understand why the sales are doing this. We're getting in the car and we're going to go to Savannah and we're going to figure this out. So we got in the car and we pulled up to the store and my employee came out and he had headsets on. His pants were kind of down below his waist. You know, he had like a Dr. Pepper in his hand. And my mom goes, you're trying to get him to sell women's shoes? Like, this is not working. I think we stayed for about a month and sold shoes together and it was incredible. And then a friend of mine that happened to live in Savannah decided to start working for me and selling shoes. And she just did an incredible job. The momentum really started taking off. Yeah. Yeah. That was in about September. And that's when I got a call from an old friend of my father's who was developing the city market in Charleston. And he said, I heard that you had this shoe business and we're opening some retail outlets in the city market. Why don't you open a store here? And I went, well, I can't even run this store. How am I possibly going to do it? But of course, I said yes, because everyone in this business knows I try everything at least three times.
Yeah, your business was still new, and there was a lot of things to the business you were now in with manufacturing and shoes, and you had challenges with your factory in San Miguel. So how did you solve your capital issue? How did you solve your manufacturing issue and the reliance on it? Like, how did you solve those infrastructure pieces before you can even really truly think to begin on that second store?
I just didn't see anything as a problem. Everything felt like an opportunity, if that makes sense.
So your factory was delivering orders as they were supposed to? Because that was a problem at one point.
Maybe sometimes, maybe 70% or 60% sometimes. It was almost crazy. There was this one shipment that came in that was a whole box of tiger printed boots. I opened the box and there are these women in the store and I go, ugh, these are not the linen sandals I needed. And I pull them out and the women go crazy.
Oh my goodness.
It was almost like this sense of excitement to anything that I was getting in because everything was new and different for people. So even if we weren't getting exactly what we wanted, I was still taking orders on things and figuring out how to work around the situations that I was presented with. My factory was kind of helping to extend credit to me to pay for the merchandise. And in turn, whatever I was selling, I was using to pay for rent or electricity or staff or what have you. So I was just continuing to fund the business with any kind of revenue that we brought in.
So then you're approached for your Charleston location. You know, obviously you're running havoc, if you will, at your Savannah store, figuring things out, making things happen. Let's talk about the expansion into your second store.
I was approached to open this store and I got to Charleston and I just thought it was an incredible and I did not want to wait until their projected open date of, I think it was January of 2011, which was only 3 months away, but I just didn't want to wait. And so I found this temporary, at the time I thought, intermediate location to open. I signed a year lease on King Street and I just said, well, I'm going to dive right into this location. It was the same situation as I had in Savannah. There were a lot of businesses closing on Lower King. Saks had just gone out of business. Ralph Lauren had just gone out of business. There were a lot of empty storefronts. And everyone thought I was completely crazy to open where I did. Because at the time, Upper King was where you wanted to go. But my thought process was all the women that live south of Broad, which was the Lower King area, were going to walk from their homes with their friends and their house guests and whoever else they had, and they would walk up Lower King to the bulk of the mainstream shopping, and they'd pass my store. That was my client for that space. Luckily, I was right. I'd rebranded the company in Charleston as Charleston Shoe Company, keeping with my theme that this is a souvenir, so it doesn't need to be Savannah, it needs to be Charleston. So everyone had this sense of pride about the people in Savannah, had this sense of pride about the Savannah Shoe Company, and likewise in Charleston. And so they had this feeling like, this is the store that only we have here. And I'm going to bring all my friends and tell all my friends. And I'm the first one to discover this store. It's going to almost be somewhat of a tourist attraction because it's so different than a normal. You're not going to the Gap. You're not going to J. Crew. You're going to this store that's in your town that's so different. And it's fun. All the people in here make you feel fun. They're wearing two different shoes and they're getting in all these random shoes that are not even in boxes at the time. We would literally get these big boxes of shoes and I would dump them out in the middle of the floor and these women would go crazy. It was a complete frenzy.
Goodness. So Charleston Shoe Company is much bigger now. It's now just Charleston Shoe Company, correct? Savannah was changed to Charleston Shoe Company as well, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. So now you have two stores. You're still really learning on the fly because now you're putting processes in place and you've grown exponentially since what year did Charleston open up?
April of 2010 is Savannah and October of 2010 was Charleston.
So within 1 year, well, really, within a few months, you opened two stores. What happened after the Charleston store opened?
Well, I was still commuting, mind you, from Memphis, Tennessee, which was 10 hours away.
Oh, my goodness.
I have a three-year-old at the time, and I'm staying in hotels, at friends' homes. There was no such thing as Airbnb or VRBO at the time, so I was just traveling from Memphis to Savannah to Charleston and back. One day I'm sitting in the Charleston store and I have my child with me, shoes everywhere, women everywhere. This woman comes in and she says, "Is this your silver station wagon in the back?" And I said, "It is." And she said, "Well, I'm about to tow it." And I go, "Oh gosh, okay." So I go to the back with her and I'd introduce myself and she says, "Oh, well, I own this building next door. Do you want to see my apartment?" And I said, "Sure." And so this woman that was about to tow my car, I'm now renting the above upstairs apartment from her. And that was my first real accommodation, if you will. I rented this apartment right above the shoe store, which helped because, and I'll probably be turned into child services for this, but my daughter, I'd put her down for a nap and since it was right upstairs, I'd have the baby monitor and I was basically selling shoes downstairs while she napped. And this one woman came in, Debbie Moore, she was adorable and she had just retired to Charleston. She came in and she bought a bunch of shoes for me and she came back the next day and bought a couple more. And then the third day she came back and she goes, "I just can't sleep. I just don't know how you're doing all this. You have no employees here. It is just you. And you have this child and you're trying to do all this. How are you doing this? I'm going to help you. You don't even have to pay me. I just have to help you." And so Debbie Moore was my first employee on King Street. And she was so much fun.
So with Debbie Moore, she comes to you because she is feeling overwhelmed for you.
Right.
Was there any, and again, when you were talking about those commuting 10 hours back and forth, I was feeling overwhelmed for you. Was there any part of you that was overwhelmed and just kind of questioning your sanity in any way?
Not at all. I mean, I was just on overdrive. I really wasn't thinking about it. You know, I didn't have a social life per se, because I was on such overdrive. And I think at the end of the day, the minute you got me horizontal, I was just out cold. And then I would pop up at 4 a.m. and start my day. I never thought about being overwhelmed. There was never a sense of, I don't know how to manage all this. I mean, I had taught myself how to use QuickBooks. I was using Excel for my POs. I taught myself how to do payroll. You know, I mean, there were all these things that I was just doing off the cuff and paying bills. And then one day, a friend of mine in Memphis was like, "I'm overwhelmed for you. Can I, like, at night after I put my kids to bed, can I pay your bills for you?" So she started doing my accounting and You know, I was just having so much fun. The high of selling shoes to all these women, it was intangible. And so I really wasn't thinking about the problems or anything. I was just on an autopilot.
Oh my goodness. You are something special, Neely. I'm telling you that right now. So now you have two stores, you have a little bit of help, a homestead for your daughter. What happens after Charleston Shoe Store?
Then of January the next year, I opened my Market Street location. Okay. And we get a call. So I have my one friend from Memphis who's running my store in Savannah. And we'd built our own e-commerce site, like with domain.com or something. Okay. And so she's running shipping out of the back of the Savannah store for that. And I'm running the Charleston store. She gets a call from this woman in Boca Grande, Florida. And she says to her, so we do this thing every year. One of our customers owns your shoes. She loves them. We do these trunk shows every other week from January to April, and we'd love you to come and participate in it. Of course, being me, I said, of course, we're going to go do this, right? So we packed up my station wagon, filled it to the brim with as many shoes as possible, drove down to Boca Grande, and in 2 days, I think we had sold something like $10,000 worth of shoes.
Oh my gosh.
And the momentum there was just absolutely crazy. And I still have customers to this day. I just went to that same trunk show last week. This is our 8th year or something doing it. But I went to that same trunk show and she goes, I remember that very first trunk show. You had a pile of shoes. It was a mound of shoes at the end of the show. The two of y'all had to figure out how to match them all back up because the frenzy that had been created over the past 2 days, we didn't even have time to put shoes back in shoe boxes. And the organizers of the show were just blown away. They go, we have never seen two people sell more product in our lives. Can you come back in 2 weeks? And we went, absolutely. So as soon as we got home, Katie started applying to all these other trunk shows and no one would give us the time of day. And then word started getting out that we had done this business in this show. And so then all these other trunk shows started calling us. And that was really a big beginning of an even bigger expansion and just promotion of the business. We literally use those trunk shows as not only marketing, testing new markets, and just sheer, it was almost like an advertisement budget to us because we would go to these new towns, we would sell hundreds of pairs of shoes in 2 days to individuals, and then the word of mouth started in these other towns and then would just spread. That was a huge time for us, and we were obviously crazy. Now, here we are doing what I was doing, commuting from Memphis to Charleston to Savannah. And now let's add in, I'm also traveling to all these other trunk shows, Vero Beach, Boca Grande, Del Rey. And so those were every weekend we'd have a different trunk show. One of the biggest trunk shows that we did that year was a trunk show that there'd been waiting lists for this trunk show for years and people couldn't get in it. And these women called us and said, we had a cancellation on this trunk show. We heard about your business. Do you want to take the main spot on the stage of the auditorium? And there are probably 30 or 40 other vendors in this show. We just were so excited. We said, absolutely. We got in the car 3 days later, drove down there, and we had myself, my mother, my employee, Katie, my sister, my husband, and my four-year-old, 3.5-year-old at the time. We're all on that stage. Gigi, my daughter, is like in a bassinet under a table surrounded by a bunch of shoeboxes. My husband is like ringing up credit cards and talking about women's bunions. My mom and my sister are on stage selling shoes. I mean, I'll never forget at the end of the show, we went back to the hotel and we calculated our sales and we had done like $27,000 in 2 days at a school auditorium. I mean, that was one, I'm getting goosebumps right now talking That's about awesome. It because when we got the total, we were just blown away. It was mayhem. It was so awesome.
That is awesome.
That's really when things started started really taking off in a crazy, unexplainable way.
That is unbelievable. So let's advance the story a little bit here. So you have these incredible trunk shows. You start expanding the business through trunk shows. How many stores do you have now?
I have 20 stores and I'm opening 6 in the next 6 weeks.
20 stores, 30% growth in the next 6 weeks from a store count. You're frequent on QVC, which requires your participation in because it's your recording the episodes with QVC. And trunk shows are still a massive part of your business, correct?
They are. And on top of that, I thought I would never do this because wholesale was so difficult for me in the early days. But probably near the end of 2011, we had so many requests for our shoes in people's stores from word of mouth that we had to open the wholesale sector up. So we also have a very big wholesale business now. We sell to 400 retailers around the country. Wow. So not only are we attending trunk shows during this time and traveling to all those stores, but we're also attending trade shows.
Oh my goodness. You are a incredibly impressive individual, Neely. So you know what? We'll call it that as well. So listeners might be listening and thinking, okay, everything she touches turns to gold. It all has worked out so incredibly well for you. And we know that you don't possess any magic powers, that you are still a human. So when you look back at your journey over the last 8 years, building to 20, almost 26 stores in a couple, actually, by the time this airs, you'll even be closer. Actually, you still won't have those stores open yet, but we're close to. So when you look back at your journey, everyone has those low points and those moments where either you question yourself or you question your ability to execute. Did you have any of those moments?
I probably still have those moments. I just don't spend a lot of time on them because I think it's so counterproductive to anything in your life. Again, it goes back to my upbringing and losing my father probably very early that I want at all times people around me to be having fun and not worrying about the small things or the things that may seem like they're really big. One of the lowest points probably in this last 8 years was my bookkeeper at the time who got married in my backyard, who was very, very close to me, right hand. I trusted her with everything. And that's probably in having fun with all my employees and feeling like they're all my best friends. I'm very trusting. And that's probably not the best quality. Anyway, one day I went, this was February of 2014.
So 3 years into your business.
Or 2015. I went to my bank account and I didn't have any money. I couldn't make payroll. The reason I even looked was because my factory had called and said, you've been late on these payments. Did you know this? And when I went to our bookkeeper at the time, she said, well, we don't have any money. And I said, how is that possible? Aren't you managing it correctly? So I went to the bank and my banker at the time is a good friend of mine. And we sat down and we looked at everything and we realized that there were these exorbitant American Express bills that had been continuing to be taken out of the bank account, upwards to the tune of $420,000 over the period of a year.
Oh, man.
I should be just totally terrified, right? I called my mom and I said, Mom, I've got to make payroll. Like, I don't know what to do. I don't have any money. At this time, I don't even know if I could borrow any money. And so, luckily, it was the perfect timing because this was February 15th and my first trunk show, the season started that week. And I remember packing up the van and I just said, I'm getting on the road right now and I'm not coming back until I have enough money to make payroll and pay the rent for, you know, at the time we probably had 6 stores, I guess, in 2015. I have to pay 6 of these stores rent and I didn't have anything. So I got on the road and we sold like we'd never sold before. Mm. And at the end of my 3-week trip, I'm on the phone with my woman that had taken over my bookkeeping. I said, okay, where are we? You know, what do we need to do here? And she said, let me get on American Express. And she got on American Express and we had a $420,000 credit. And they had refunded all of the fraudulent activity.
Wow.
And at the same time, I had been on the road for 3 weeks and made enough money to pay my bills. I have goosebumps again because wow. I remember at that end of the trip just how excited I was that we had done this and we had overcome this situation that could have been completely catastrophic.
Yeah.
I couldn't pay payroll and couldn't pay rent.
Wow. That's unbelievable. How has that changed how you have managed the business since?
It probably should have changed me a lot more than it did. I'm still very trusting. I have too much to do to not be. And I have too much faith in humanity and in my employees and my friends and everything to really imagine that someone could be unfaithful. And so I really think that I still probably, that is one of my shortcomings in my delegation, which we all have to do, especially at this stage. I've got to not be involved in every aspect. It would be nearly impossible, even though I continue to remain involved in how much did we spend on pencils last week? And what did we, you know, I'm still very much a micromanager in that sense. And you have to be. I think if you didn't, there are parts of the business, and I see them when I stop paying attention to certain aspects of the business, I see them going down. And you have to constantly reinvent those sectors and reinvent how you're involved in them as well.
Entrepreneurship is not a solo flight. People try to go alone and at some point they break or they fail. And part of that is maintaining a focus of the shoulders that we stood upon to get to where we are. And so when you look on your journey, who do you look back at as so critical to the success you're experiencing now and the fulfillment you're experiencing now that you just look back with such immense gratitude towards? Who are those people?
There's so many, and that is one hard aspect of this journey is the regret of where those people in your life went during all of this, if that makes sense. And so there's a huge sense of gratitude for my family and my friends and the friends that came into the business to help. And we got so crazy for a while there, and we were all wearing so many hats that I feel like there was just, where are we going and what are we doing? And we don't know how to stop this horse that all those people that were throughout the business, from my mom to my husband, people were trying to take care of Gigi and help sell shoes. And obviously I would not be here if I hadn't had all those people in the early days, just never saying no. You know, they were just constantly hitting the pavement with me and we were all just having a great time and we were really all on this fun high until it became this really big job that no one really knew what to do. So now we have, I mean, I think we sent out 280 W-2s this year. And obviously each one of those people that plays me in all of those locations really takes every aspect of the job I had when I started and has blown it up into its own job title.
Yeah.
I had all those 280 jobs at one time, and now it's amazing that there are that many of them.
Yeah.
And so it's so exciting to see some of them. I mean, right now I have 4 employees currently, at least 4, that started working for me when they were 17.
Wow.
And still work for me today. 2 of them run their own division of the company, and they basically were responsible for creating that division. They're my children. And everyone always goes, well, you only have 1 daughter. Are you going to have more children? I go, I have 280 children. And they're women.
That's awesome.
So, you know, they're coming to me about everything. Some of them live with me. sometimes. And so I'm very thankful and I'm very grateful for all those people that were in my life when I first started and are in my life today and have all put up with my crazy whirlwind life.
Oh my goodness, that's incredible. So the last question, I'd like you to picture yourself sitting down for coffee with one listener at a time. And this listener is someone who has started a company and just has a tremendous amount of frustration that it's not getting the amount of traction that it's getting, or it's a lot harder than they had thought it was, they would be when they started. Or maybe the person you're sitting down with coffee with is someone who is working a 9-to-5 and has a mortgage and kids, and maybe they're later on in life, but there's some narrative they have in their head as to why they can't pursue this book of dreams that they have, these ideas and these concepts they want to bring to market. They know they'd be more fulfilled by it, but there's just something that is holding them back from it. Or maybe this person you're having coffee with is an individual that has tried numerous times to bring a product or service to market and has failed to any variable degree, but they've never succeeded at something when it comes to their entrepreneurship. What do you say to one or all of those people during this time where you're just sitting with them one-on-one?
That same very first question that you asked me, what do you have to lose other than this short life and the experiences that you're going to have pursuing it? I just think you have to take the fear factor away and really decide if this is something you really want to do, just do it. Nike, like just do it. I know that that's so easy for me to say now, having succeeded somewhat in this wild dream that I had, but I still have those every day. I mean, opening New York is terrifying to me, but if I don't try it, I'd never know if it would have worked.
There are so many powerful learnings from Neely's story, but there are two specific items that I want to key in on. The first is the power of having a partner that is there when it gets ugly. Now, I don't mean a business partner or a loved one, although their support is incredibly important as well. I mean a financial partner. We don't talk about this enough, but it's so important. See, just 4 years into the growth of the Charleston Shoe Company, Neely discovered a loss of $420,000 due to internal fraud. American Express walked alongside her during that time and made her whole by crediting the entire $420,000 within weeks. It was not a long, drawn-out process. American Express is such a huge supporter of small businesses everywhere, so consider Neely's experience when looking at your next small business loan or credit card. Pick a partner that's going to support small business like ours that will be there when it matters most. The second key takeaway was how powerful Neely's perspective has been throughout everything she has been through. Throughout her journey, Neely kept saying that she did not see things as an obstacle, but as an opportunity. She did not think about the possibility of failure because she saw the opportunity. She always tried things at least 3 times because of the opportunity. Do you hear that? The opportunity. Can you pick up what makes Neely so unique? It's her perspective and presence in the moment. Think back to how she handled the situation when she discovered her close trusted employee had embezzled $420,000. Her response was to simply focus on the opportunity at hand, and that was to ensure payroll was met. She was not distracted by the panic that could have set in because she was out the $420,000. Her years of seeing the opportunities above the challenge or obstacle enabled her to focus on what mattered most. She did not get distracted by worry or fear or panic. She locked in on the opportunity. Now, Neely's story turned out great in this case, as she was able to earn that money through weeks on the road doing trunk shows, and she had the powerful backing of American Express, who credited her account for those fraudulent charges. And I know it does not always work out that well. In fact, my dad built a multi-million dollar print shop only to have it shut down due to an embezzlement situation. We have zero control of the output, but we have full control of the input. Begin to shift your perspective on the challenges, the opportunities that we are facing at this very moment. As if Neely didn't already provide us with a tremendous amount of value, she's extending a discount offer of 15% on all purchases at charlestonshoeco.com. We will have a link in the show notes, so make sure you check that out. Buy whatever you like and just enter the code STARTUPSTORY when you check out. Based on Neely's story, I know I'm a fan, I'll be picking up a few pairs for my wife. Again, use the discount code STARTUPSTORY when you check out. We've included a link to her website in our show notes, as well as a copy of the discount code. Also, make sure to follow them on Instagram, Charleston Shoe Co. Awareness is incredibly important to our founders, and we hear from every single founder how hard it is to get the necessary visibility. So let's show Neely and the Charleston Shoe Company some love on Instagram. Now for my personal ask. The Startup Story community has been so incredible with sharing our podcast with others, but we have more stories to tell and more people to reach. We are a startup, and the most powerful way you can support the Startup Story podcast is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at thestartupstory.co. Share the Startup Story on your social media, either with a link or a screenshot. Make sure you tag or mention us at thestartupstory.co so we can see your help and say thank you for it. And lastly, share the podcast on your LinkedIn profile. The Startup Story is for entrepreneurs, so please do not underestimate the power of sharing the Startup Story on your LinkedIn profile so other entrepreneurs can discover us. In fact, most people struggle to share good content on LinkedIn anyways, so if you want to support the Startup Story, then search for the Startup Story company page, follow us, and share our posts to help encourage other founders and spread the word about the podcast. Every single founder has a story, and the startup stories we bring to you every week can encourage and inspire another founder. It might just be what they needed to hear to keep moving forward on their dreams. I look forward to sharing these stories every Tuesday with hopes to inspire you to start your story.